91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. In recent years, the number of unionized American workers has fallen to less than 12%. Some Democrats have joined conservative Republicans with right-to-work leanings, and recent fast food worker strikes and Occupy movements have had little effect. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Today, we'll visit with longtime union activist, journalist, and educator Steve Early. He has the historical and hands-on experience to relate the decline of unionism in America. Early has written Save Our Unions, Dispatches from a Movement in Distress. And what's the current relationship of unions with the Democratic Party? Stay tuned. Topical Currents up next after the news. And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. For the next hour, we discuss the status and history of today's labor unions with longtime union activist, journalist, negotiator, and lawyer Steve Early. Can American unions be reinvigorated while facing powerful forces of right-to-work states, pared-down benefits, and weakened collective bargaining?
Steve Early has written Save Our Unions, Dispatches from a Movement in Distress, and he joins us via Skype from Richmond, California. Welcome to you, Steve Early.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Pleasure to have you. What views of today's unions do you think the average American holds?
Well, I think it's a big country, and people have many different views of unions, depending on their own work situation, what part of the country they live in, and perhaps whether or not they're a member. I think one accurate perception that most people would have, whether they are pro or anti-union, is that union strength and influence has declined in recent years. A pretty well-documented trend. After World War II, as much as 30 or 35% of the U.S. workforce had the benefits of union representation and contract protection. Today, that's down overall to about 11% of the workforce and less than 7% in the private sector. So that's quite a steady drop over the last half century.
Well, how much of this steep decline in recent decades do you think can be attributed directly to the unions themselves?
Well, I think unions, like any human entities, any membership organizations, have warts and flaws and shortcomings. And I say that as a 40-year union member and activist. However, I think that the real sources of union decline are external. We've seen a major restructuring of our economy over the last 50 years, a shift from manufacturing, which used to be quite heavily unionized in this country, to the service sector. We've seen offshoring of a lot of jobs that has also reduced union membership. Trends like free trade and deregulation of major industries. A whole restructuring of work, which has led many employers to no longer directly employ large numbers of workers and to reclassify them often illegally and incorrectly as independent contractors. So there's a lot of trends and forces that have come together to reduce union clout.
It seems that recently we only hear about union actions in terms of fast food workers and retail workers. What about other areas?
Well, there's there was quite a rebound in union activity just last year involving thousands of workers in your own state of Florida. Higher paid workers, flight attendants, pilots, passenger service employees at major airlines, including American and Virgin and JetBlue, all voted for union representation in 2014, 20,000 of them in all, and many of them based in Florida airports and other parts of the South. So that certainly doesn't, that part of our workforce doesn't conform to the profile of the minimum wage worker. These are skilled workers, white collar workers, many of them already making fairly decent salaries, but wanting a greater voice on their job that they don't have unless they have collective bargaining rights.
How about union organizing defeats in recent times? How about the Volkswagen business in Chattanooga, Tennessee?
Well, that's, I think, a very interesting case study in unions responding to an election defeat, a loss of a National Labor Relations Board vote on whether or not to unionize a particular plant in a different way. As your listeners may know from following it in the news, Volkswagen is a German-owned company that is generally quite union-friendly worldwide. It has a manufacturing plant in Chattanooga. It agreed to an election among its 14 or 1500 factory workers about a year ago involving the United Auto Workers. Management in the plant did not campaign against the union, but a lot of outside union critics did, Republican, state, and federal officials. And by a very narrow vote, the United Auto Workers lost, was not able to demonstrate majority support for unionization. But the UAW still had a very strong following in the plant, and what's happened since that election is quite unusual. Volkswagen has agreed to recognize what you might call minority unions in the plant. The UAW has formed a branch. It is signing up members who are paying dues voluntarily. There is a second organization of workers in the plant called the American Council of Employees. It's critical of the UAW. It is also signing up members. Both of them are trying to provide representation to workers in the plant and are meeting and discussing wages and hours and working conditions separately with the same employer. Much more the kind of situation that exists in Europe than in the U.S., but I think a step forward for workers' rights and representation.
We'd like to engage our listeners. Your thoughts about unions, your views. Are you currently in a union that you feel is working for you, or were you ever? Our number, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. Or you can email radio@WLRN.org. radio@WLRN.org. Steve, you worked for the Communications Workers of America, the CWA, for 27 years. What did you do and why did you end up leaving?
Well, I'm still a very active part of the union out here in California as a freelance journalist. I belong to the CWA-affiliated Newspaper Guild local in San Francisco. So even after I left the National Union staff, I continued to be a union activist. Mm-hmm. During the many years that I was a full-time union official, my job was to work with local union branches on contract negotiations, on organizing campaigns, legislative and political activity, leadership training, helping workers with individual job problems and grievances, a lot of labor management meetings, and occasionally supporting them in strike activity when that became necessary. CWA is a very interesting union, very diverse, represents everybody from flight attendants to manufacturing workers to traditional telephone workers at companies like AT&T and Verizon. Also has many workers in healthcare and the public sector.
How has the broad fragmentation of the communications industry affected their relationships with unions?
Well, there has been a major transformation of the telecommunications industry since the breakup of the old Bell system in 1984. The major impact, both in terms of industry restructuring and new technology, has been something that we all are part of, which is the growth of wireless telephones. It's led to an industry which is unionized in its traditional landline side and much less unionized on its cell phone side. So we have the example in Florida and elsewhere of a very responsible union-friendly employer, AT&T Wireless or Mobility, 40,000 workers have the benefits of union representation, contract coverage, but we also have some leading wireless providers, T-Mobile and Verizon Wireless, that have been very resistant to respecting workers' rights to organize and bargain. So the main challenge in telephone right now is the growth sector of the industry is not as unionized as the traditional telephone side continues to be.
Sticking with you for a moment, what is your background? How did you come to be a union activist and a labor journalist? How did that happen?
Well, I had a little experience as a union member myself in the mid-1960s. Like many young people, trying to raise some money to go to college, I worked for a retail food store chain during the summer and after school. I became a member of the Retail Clerks International Association, now known as the United Food and Commercial Workers. Then went to college, got very involved in the anti-war movement of the late 1960s. Decided that I wanted to continue to be an activist after I graduated. Thought the labor movement might be a promising vehicle for political activism involving workers' rights. Went to law school to acquire some skills that might be useful in assisting workers, and went to work for my first union job in Washington in 1974 with the United Mine Workers, and have been involved in the labor movement ever since.
We're speaking with Steve Early. He's a nationally recognized author and journalist with expertise on the American labor movement. He's been an organizer, strike strategist, educator, lawyer, and much more. His latest book is Save Our Unions, Dispatches from a Movement in Distress. We're going to take a break and we'll come back and talk some more.
And it is today's Topical Currents, 19 minutes past 1 o'clock. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Steve Early. He's a union activist, journalist, negotiator, and lawyer. And his book is called Save Our Unions, Dispatches from a Movement in Distress. We also have some callers on the line. We'll be getting to them soon. If you'd like to be one of them, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. WLRN. Steve, in your book, you've criticized unions, including the Service Employees International Union. Why that criticism? And also tell us more about the National Union of Healthcare Workers in California.
Well, my criticism of some unions has mainly been in the area of their internal functioning. I think for unions to fulfill their potential as an effective, authentic voice of workers in the workplace, they need to be democratic. They need to be responsive to their members, to their rank and file. The dues-paying members need to have the opportunity to elect the union officials who represent them, to elect their union shop stewards. They need to be able to actively participate in contract negotiations, the elected bargaining committees, the finances of the organization need to be very transparent. Most unions do a good job in all these areas. Some do not do such a good job, and that's why occasionally unions are the scene of union reform movements, or, as in the case of the National Union of Healthcare Workers out here in California, an attempt to create a rival union. Members break away, reform, create an organization that they feel is more member-driven, and attempt to do a better job of representing workers in a particular industry, in this case, healthcare. So I think sometimes what is needed is both internal reform and rejuvenation of labor organizations, and when that's not possible or it fails, creation of new unions that might be more responsive to the members they represent.
What part do you think current union leadership in some unions is a contributing factor?
Well, I think one of the concerns of union reformers historically, in a union like the Teamsters, has been the fact that the top leadership not in all locals, but certainly historically in the National Union, has tended to get a little bit out of touch with the rank and file simply by paying itself too much. Mm-hmm. There are unions, I'm sad to report, in this country whose leaders make hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, far more than the working members who pay for those salaries, whose interests they're supposed to represent. So one reform that I favor is making sure that the salaries of full-time union representatives and elected officials have some reasonable relationship to the pay of the people who are working members of the organization.
Yeah, as I was preparing for this show, it just struck me the irony that, you know, labor versus management was at the heart of the need for unions, and that it would become labor versus management within the union itself.
Well, I think in a misguided way, there are some unions who feel that one survival strategy under very difficult circumstances in the U.S. today is to become more like a business, to turn what's supposed to be an organization by and for workers into more of a management style operation. I have nothing wrong with efficiency. I have nothing wrong with learning what we can learn from good organizational practices that may be found within business enterprises. But I think fundamentally unions are a very different entity. They're membership organizations. They need to be democratic. They need to be structured in a way that develops new leaders. They shouldn't be top down. They should be bottom up. And that when we try to transplant some of the models of business to the labor movement, it's not helpful.
Tell us more about the union of what you term in the book the House of Lords, the meetings annually held in Florida, and I think in January, Florida, so they may be going on right now. But some of them included, your stories included the now raised Sheraton Bal Harbor Hotel and the Fontainebleau, and also meetings in Orlando.
Well, as you know, your great state is a magnet for all kinds of people suffering from winter weather in northern states, and among them are national leaders of the unions affiliated with the AFL-CIO, the American Federation of Labor Congress of Industrial Organizations, which for decades has had its annual meeting first near Miami and now more often in Orlando. I was kind of poking fun at this practice. A lot of rank-and-file activists have long said that it would behoove the top leadership of labor to conduct its meetings perhaps closer to the action in Rust Belt cities on the front lines of worker struggles in other parts of the country. It really doesn't project a good image to be going to, in my view, a resort, a casino city to have your annual meeting discussion. The other issue that I hinted at in that article is the fact that the top leadership of the American labor is really too old. It's too pale and stale and male in many cases. There has been greater diversity in the leadership in some unions. Women, people of color, even gay trade unionists assuming top positions in some unions. But we still have a problem with people sticking around too long and not creating enough opportunities for younger labor leaders to emerge.
And we'll take a few phone calls. We're talking with union activist, journalist, negotiator, and lawyer Steve Early. First caller, we've got David in Boca Raton. Thanks for being so patient, David. Hi.
Hi. It's nice to be able to talk to you. For quite a while now, I've reached a conclusion that one of the reasons why there's such a vast separation in income between the working class in this country and the haves, the wealthy, is the depression and almost exclusion in some places of unions. Now, the unions were a vital and necessary thing 100 years ago when it was almost a master-slave relationship between business owners and their workforce. And over the years, even up into the 1950s, the quality of lifestyle was good because of unions. But as was pointed out, the unions abused their strength and lost favor in some places. However, now these right-to-work, so-called right-to-work states such as Florida, are really right-to-fire states. And the individuals here that work for less than a reasonable wage either are too ignorant or uninterested in understanding that when they vote in the elections, they're voting to put people in our legislature who are continue to depress their wages in favor of the businessman in this state. This is such a business-oriented state today that families cannot survive on the wages that they're being paid. And I think there's a need again for the strength of the unions, and that's going to come from the people who work. They have to vote. They have to express themselves, and they're just not knowledgeable. There was a show on about a month ago that indicated there were 700,000 people in this state who needed Medicare that weren't getting it because of our governor and the Republican legislature. Chris lost by 70,000 votes. If more than 10% of those 700,000 had voted, a Chris administration would have provided Medicare for those people and a higher minimum wage.
David, you're bringing up a lot of points. Could you please let Mr. Early address some of them?
I'm finished, and thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
I think all of those points were very well taken. The one I'd want to respond to that David raised was the kind of disconnect in many states between the recent setbacks that labor-backed candidates faced and the far greater success of ballot measures boosting the minimum wage. In 20 states this month, more than 3 million workers are going to get a raise as a result of recent legislative action or voters approving a minimum wage increase in their state. Four of the states where people are going to be getting a boost of some sort are Alaska, Arkansas, Nebraska, and South Dakota. None of them known at the moment for their strong unions, and in fact, all the scene of Republican gains last fall. So I think the fact that we do have a serious problem with wage stagnation, people are having a great deal of difficulty even holding two or three jobs and then making ends meet, has really fed this movement for raising the minimum wage. And all around the country, we're seeing the products of that, cities, states, raising the minimum wage, and it's now benefiting millions of people. But in the absence of collective bargaining, which was the more traditional way of people negotiating themselves a pay increase with their individual employer.
And we'll move along with some other callers. This is Monica in Miami. Hi.
Hi. Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I have been a union member for over 20 years now in the state of Florida, and even though for up to the last 2 years, I was a very strong and devoted union member. I've been quite disappointed in my union for the last couple of years for their lack of, I think, more a stronger, a more aggressiveness in helping their union members have more fairness and more opportunities of work. Because this is a right to work state, I feel that maybe they have their hands tied and they can't do anything about, giving more opportunities to their members.
Steve Early.
Well, I sympathize with Monica's concern and the condition that her union finds itself in Florida. Florida has been, as you know, for many decades a so-called right-to-work state. That means that employers are prohibited from negotiating agreements with unions that require everybody represented by the union to pay either membership dues or what's called an agency fee if they don't want to join the union for the cost of the services and the benefits that they receive. So union membership is voluntary, and unions have to do a very good job of being responsive to their members to maintain levels of membership, 70%, 80%, 90%, in that kind of environment that enable them to be effective in contract negotiations and day-to-day representation of members. One of the things that sometimes hampers union performance is the lack of a workplace network, not enough resources putting into training and developing elected shop stewards, co-workers who can help explain people's rights and benefits under the union contract, who can assist them in meetings with employers, who can provide information about relevant labor laws. Unless unions invest heavily in providing that kind of infrastructure in the workplace and encouraging the active participation of the rank and file, you may have bargaining rights, you may have a signed agreement, but you may not feel in the workplace day to day that you really have a union.
Yes, correct.
Okay, thank you very much for your call.
Okay, thank you, Monica.
Thank you.
We have an emailer that is very much like that call, but we need to take a break first. We're speaking with Steve Early, and he's written Save Our Unions, Dispatches from a Movement in Distress. We'll be right back on Topical Currents. And we're back with Topical Currents, speaking with recognized author and journalist Steve Early, with a specialty on the American labor movement. He's written Save Our Unions, Dispatches from a Movement in Distress. We're going to take more calls and emails. We'd love to hear from you. Your view of unions, should they again wield more power, would you join one if you had the chance? 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. This is Saul, Steve Early, who writes, how can union members deal with bureaucracy and being abandoned by a union?
Well, there's a couple of resources that I would highly recommend. One is an organization that I belong to for 40 years. It's based in Brooklyn, New York. You can Google it. It's called the Association for Union Democracy. It's kind of like the American Civil Liberties Union for disgruntled union members. Not the kind of union members that want to get rid of the union, but the kind of union members that want to make it better and more democratic and more transparent and more effective. And the AUD, as it's called, can provide information to individual union members about how to improve their union, democratize it, run for office, reform union structures, and so forth. In particular unions, there are similar reform caucuses, and the Teamsters is a group called Teamsters for a Democratic Union based in Detroit. It's made enormous progress over the last three or four decades, improving the functioning of the Teamsters Union, which used to have a very troubled history of racketeering and corruption. Today functions in much better fashion, in large part due to the dedicated activities of thousands of members of Teamsters for Democratic Union. So I think there's lots of models for getting together with coworkers who share your concern, forming a reform group or caucus, running some candidates for office, and changing the direction of the organization that you're part of.
How about the impact of the Affordable Care Act and labor unions?
Well, it's definitely been a mixed bag. To start with the the glass that's half full, we do want to appreciate the fact that the Affordable Care Act in states where this has been permitted has greatly expanded Medicaid coverage. Very low paid people had to struggle to get health care. Millions more now have it. In many other ways, though, the Affordable Care Act has not change the situation of union members with better health plans much at all, and in some cases has even made it more difficult for them to continue to bargain about job-based medical benefits. There continues to be a lot of pressure, even from very profitable employers, for health care cost shifting in union contract negotiations, and unions around the country are still fighting employer demands for health care givebacks, some of them actually being sought by employers who claim that these are necessary because of particular provisions of the Affordable Care Act.
We have another emailer, Leah, who says, at the same time that the influence of labor unions has diminished, I wonder why it is that police unions have remained so powerful. Do you know the answer to that?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question. Police unions are part of a broader traditional structure, union structure, in which membership is pretty much limited to one craft or occupation. Another example in the public sector would be firefighters, but traditional private sector example would be building trades workers, who are, for the most part, in unions organized along craft lines, plumbers, carpenters, iron workers, all in their own separate organizations. It's a very different structure than the much more mixed industrial, public, private sector union membership base of a union like the communication workers. Having everybody in the same occupation, you know, gives you a lot more coherence as an organization, mm-hmm. tends to make you a little bit more parochial, more focused on the narrow interests of your members alone. Certainly in a uniform service like the police, there's an additional layer of togetherness, solidarity, feeling of being part of a special tribe that I think creates a kind of solidarity, which can be positive, but we've also seen some very negative manifestations of it recently in the debates around the country about the need for police reform.
Well, wouldn't it be a good political value for government officials to show that they're, you know, quote, tough on crime and support the police department?
Well, where I live out here in Richmond, California.
Or the police workers.
Yeah. I mean, we have a police department that's been under transformation for 10 years. The police chief, Chris Magnus, is a widely recognized innovator in the area of community policing. He's also a former police union leader himself, so he's had experience both in labor and management in public safety work. And I think he has tried to maintain good relations with the unions representing the 200 officers in the police department here, but he has also really reoriented the department in a very necessary way, rebuilding its relationships with the community, becoming more transparent, and really developing a mode of policing that has restored the confidence of a largely non-white community in the capacity of the police to protect and properly serve them.
And we'll move along to some of our callers. Next up, it's Bob. He's in Miami. Hey there. Bob, you're up.
Hello. Yeah, it's Todd. It's not Bob.
I'm sorry.
Not a problem. Yeah, my question is, I wanted to talk a little bit about the difference between private and municipal unions. Seems to me in the private sector, there's this natural feedback loop where workers can strike, employers can lock workers out, and ultimately workers can drive employers out of business. You can't drive a municipality out of business, and while a sanitation worker can certainly go on strike, a city's never going to lock out their sanitation workers. You know, people like FDR, you know, a lot of people talked about in the old days that municipal unions really don't work when it comes to collective bargaining. And it seems to me you've got the system today where you've got this, you know, really questionable loop between politicians and municipal unions where they get these people elected, they give them more, they put money into their coffers, and that those, and there's no checks and balance on the municipal side. I want you to talk about that a little bit.
Well, I think the situation is a little bit more murky than that. Let's take the situation of teachers today, an embattled public sector union group for sure. There are politicians now in both major parties, Democrats and Republicans, who have aligned themselves with the corporate-backed so-called educational reform movement. And in many parts of the country, mayors, both Democrats and Republicans, are putting a lot of pressure on teachers to renegotiate their contracts, to weaken their job security, to eliminate various forms of tenure and job rights, to increase class size, and to privatize part of the public school systems that they're a part of. I don't think at this point teachers are feeling like a group of public employees who are particularly coddled by public officials, including some of those that they have helped to elect. And in fact, there's quite a bit of turmoil in many major city affiliates of both the National Education Association and the American Federation of Teachers because of conflict with municipal officials and school board members and mayors who purported to be friends of labor, including teachers, and now in office are pursuing what teachers themselves to be perceived to be a very anti-public education, anti-teacher agenda.
Well, yeah, but I guess I'd ask the question, that hasn't happened in a vacuum. There's this debate in this country as to whether or not our public schools are a colossal failure, and the teachers' unions, rightly or wrongly, are perceived as being an obstacle to progress in this matter. I mean, it's not like people one day decided, let's beat up on school teachers.
Correct. And I think that's a misperception that has been created in part through some actions by some teachers' unions. But overall, I view the situation as one in which there's massive scapegoating of a workforce which is overwhelmingly dedicated and committed to doing the difficult work of educating young people in public schools, and who cannot solve all of our larger social and economic problems in the classroom. If you don't look at the larger context in which public schools fail or are troubled in many of our big cities, I think simply going after the teachers is not going to lead to many great improvements in public education. The teachers, where they've been most successful in recent years, have built very strong alliances, for example, in Chicago, with the students, with parents, with communities relying on public schools. They've fought school closings. They fought for smaller class size. They've fought for more resources. There's lots of ways that teachers can ally with the public they serve to make the schools better, and they're doing that in many cities.
We need to take another break, our last break. We have lots of calls and lots of emails, so stay right there, and we'll get to you. We're speaking with union activist, journalist, and lawyer Steve Early. Stay with us.
And 46 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with Steve Early. He's the author of Save Our Unions, Dispatches from a Movement in Distress. There also will be links to that book at the WLRN.org website and our Topical Currents Facebook page. Back to our callers, Vanessa. She's in Key West. Hi.
Hi there. Fascinating discussion. Can you hear me okay?
Sure.
I grew up with stirring Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie songs, and have always had a profound respect for union movements. However, I'm intrigued with developments in the economy where companies such as Uber that are sort of part of the sharing economy emerging group have just strictly sort of contract workers working for them, and so they have no obligation to pay taxes for them or you know, give them health insurance or anything. How do you respond to how the union movement can evolve so that it can represent these types of individuals?
Vanessa, you're talking about independent contractors?
Yes.
Okay. Steve?
Very, very good question. And the problem is much, much broader than the Uber phenomena. Look at a field like trucking. You know, you have a couple of different models for an employment relationship. United Parcel Service, you know, everybody sees Big Brown in operation around them. Every part of the country, largest unionized employer in the country. Workers have a contract, they're Teamster members, they have real pensions, decent health care coverage, overtime pay, health and safety protection, and you know, not a company known for hiring slackers, but competing against FedEx, which in the new fashion has completely restructured its relationship even to its delivery car drivers, tried to turn them into independent contractors responsible for their own vehicle expenses, no workers' comp coverage, not eligible for unemployment insurance, no job-related benefits. That is the new model, and it's a horrendous one. So a lot of legal challenges are being filed now, including against firms like FedEx, challenging the misclassification of workers who are really employees as contractors to offload these responsibilities onto the workers themselves. There's organizational efforts, for example, in the area of port trucking. The Teamsters Union in many parts of the country has been trying to build organizations of the independent truckers who haul goods to and from our major ports. There's lots of examples around the country. Adjunct professors are organizing, again, a group that was seen as disposable labor and unorganizable until a few years ago. So whether this restructuring of work is affecting blue-collar workers, white-collar workers, professionals, or folks with different kinds of skills, it poses both an organizing challenge and very often a need to sue the employer involved because they're violating the law when they shed their employer responsibilities in this fashion.
By law, what is an independent contractor?
Well, there's a narrow definition of it, which has to do with how much supervision and control the employer exercises. And clearly what's happened in many situations is that employers are still directing a workforce, but they've created a sham relationship by treating them as independent contractors, or they've hired an intermediary, a manpower, a temp agency, to handle the actual payroll responsibilities while maintaining overall control for the employment conditions. This has led to litigation involving the fast food chains and their franchisees about co-employer responsibility.
Saul writes, how can you buck management if you and others want union representation but management does not?
Well, we need to keep in mind that it is a federal law that workers have the right to come together, not even as formally as in a unionization effort, but in any kind of collective activity on the job aimed at improving their wages, hours, and working conditions. That right is sadly often not respected by employers, so people sometimes have to assert their rights, going to the National Labor Relations Board, filing unfair labor practice charges, and taking other legal steps. But the fundamental right of workers to come together, to associate, to form an organization, a committee, a delegation, to go and express their collective concerns to management is protected in federal law, and in some states for public employees, protected by state law as well.
Did you want to take another call?
Yeah, let's try one more before we... Lewis in Miami, hi.
Hi, good afternoon, Mr. Early. I was wondering in the last few minutes here that you have, if you could address the double-edged sword or phenomenon that's been routinely seen, we've witnessed in the airline industry of federal mediators allowing corporations, the airlines, to negotiate for almost indefinite periods of time where negotiations last 6, 7, 8 years. And then the other side of the sword being that once a union is released for self-help, that the government is then called in very quickly to convene a presidential emergency board to stop whatever self-help the union might take at that point. I was wondering if you could address that point.
Well, there certainly have been some protracted and quite frustrating for the workers involved bargaining scenarios in recent years arising under the Railway Labor Act, which covers the airline industry and the railroads. I think these situations are a little specialized, not as typical of labor relations controversies elsewhere in the private sector or the public sector. But they certainly can make it difficult for, say, airline workers to reach a fair agreement if they thwart the kind of collective action that may sometimes be necessary to get it.
Okay, Lewis?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Steve Early, what do you consider the biggest lessons the labor movement and unions should take from these last decades of decline?
Well, I think unions function best and are most popular and perceived well when they're fighting not just for the interests of their own members, but for all workers and their families. There's 89% of the workforce out there without the benefit of a collective voice, many fewer rights, much less ability to impact public policy. When unions frame their struggles and position themselves as the defenders of a broader working class, not just the minority of workers who have the benefits of union representation, I think they succeed much more of the time and generate much more popular support. You know, we have a century of progress. It's benefited millions of non-union workers who now are protected by child labor laws, factory safety rules, workers' compensation, the 8-hour day, unemployment insurance, Social Security, pension reform, the Family and Medical Leave Act. None of these protective state or federal labor laws would ever have been passed without the intervention and activity of union members. They weren't proposed by employers. So that's the kind of thing that I think unions need to do more of to revive and to rebuild and to regain the more honored place that they might have enjoyed in American society in the past.
Where are unions still powerful, and where do they continue to still have an impact?
Well, there's certainly a high density of union membership in public school teaching, not in all states, but in many, in the telecommunications industry, in utilities, in trucking. There's a number of areas where, if well organized and the unions involved are high functioning, workers are still able to secure decent working conditions, decent pay, decent benefits. And in the case of, say, transit workers, help the public that they serve fight for improvement in public services.
Do you foresee growth of globalized union movements?
Well, it's been a very important trend in recent years that American unions have reached out on a cross-border basis mm-hmm. to create alliances with unions around the globe. I mean, we're up against global corporations, multinational firms. My own union has had a long-running campaign with a major German firm involving the wireless company T-Mobile. Mm. The auto workers at Volkswagen work with the German metal workers. Workers of the world do need to unite through their respective unions when they're dealing with common employers. It only makes sense.
We have just a quick email to know if you've heard of micro unions.
Yeah, I mean, it's a concept really similar to what I think is playing out in the Volkswagen plant, where the traditional model of one union having exclusive bargaining rights representing everybody is giving way to a more pluralistic situation where maybe two, three, four different worker organizations might exist in the same workplace or within the same firm, pursuing the interests of different segments of the workforce and hopefully getting the attention of management and even without formal bargaining, winning some changes and improvements that benefit the workers.
Do you see a time in the future when supporting unions from a political figure is worth votes rather than costing them votes?
Well, again, that varies very much depending on where you're running for office, what state, what part of the country. One of the politicians that I most admire who's profiled in Save Our Unions, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who's now making noises about running for president, has long had strong union support in his home state of Vermont because he's been a vigorous defender of real health care reform, of labor law reform. He's been a critic of free trade agreements. He's been someone who's been willing to come out and support strikes and picket lines. And I think if he gets involved in a race for the presidency, he's going to provide quite a contrast to Hillary Clinton, the presumed leader in the race for the Democratic nomination for 2016.
Well, we'll end there. Steve Early is a union activist, journalist, negotiator, and lawyer. And his latest book is Save Our Unions, Dispatches from a Movement in Distress. Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Thank you. And thanks for listening this hour. Apologies to those we couldn't get on the air. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Tomorrow we begin with former Wall Street technical whiz Caroline Arnold. In her new book, she describes how to spend less time on the mundane and more on life's true assets. It's Small Move, Big Change, with info on how to keep your resolutions intact. I will read it next week. Also, Linda Gassenheimer and noted chefs and wine columnist Fred Tasker. Of course, we'll be with you tomorrow at 1 o'clock. This is Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for listening. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today.